welcome to another edition of Childhood Remastered. This is the podcast where we look back on the cartoons and TV shows and movies and whatnot of our youth to see if they're still worth a damn.
Or not.
Or not, which is far too often the case. I am Sean.
And I'm Chris.
And today we're going to be continuing our holiday theme and looking at a movie that was based off of a opera, which was...
Nope.
No.
It's based on a ballet, which is based on a short story.
Which is based on some craziness that someone thought up at some point.
Yes.
And that movie is?
The Nutcracker Prince.
Now, this Nutcracker Prince was from the way back time of 1990 with Dayglow Jeans, the very end of the 80s, coming off of that me, go-go 80s.
It was a magic time.
It was a magic time that no one should remember. I actually do not like the early 90s. I think it is my least favorite time in terms of, like, fashion and just, like, culture.
Well, we did have Star Trek.
We did. Okay, that was one good thing.
We did have Next Generation, so yeah. The early 90s was not a complete waste.
Yeah.
So this, The Nutcracker Prince, is a Canadian animated romantic fantasy film, and honestly, who fucking writes these descriptions?
That is a genre and a half right there.
I feel like somebody just made that up. But I like pulling these weird descriptions off the internet now because they're just so stupid.
I will say that one of my favorite genres of film is my post-apocalyptic cowboy movies.
Okay, yeah. I know that's like a very distinct genre.
It's a very
niche genre.
or like post-apocalyptic sci-fi cowboy something.
So post-apocalyptic cowboy would Wild Wild West fall into that?
A little bit, actually.
A little bit.
Not
giant mecha spiders.
Yeah, not too post-apocalyptic, but yeah, that'd be like steampunk cowboy right there.
So this movie actually was released twice in 1990 and in 1991, U.S. and then
UK, I think.
Yeah, I think Canada, but whatever. It had a runtime of 75 minutes. Rotten Tomatoes, it has a viewer score rating of 71%, actually.
And I wonder if a lot of that is people who remember it.
It could be. There's not a whole lot of reviewer scores. Actually, the 71% is a combination. I remember now. The 71% is a combination of both reviewer and watching
viewers.
Scores. Yeah. So it was the first production by both Lacewood Productions and Hinton Animation Studios to be released theatrically. Lacewood Studios, which we'll kind of get into in a minute, are sort of part of the... they're partly responsible for the dumpster fire of the Super Mario Brothers live-action movie.
Yeah!
So this movie, The Nutcracker Prince, only made $1.78 million in the box office sales, and I couldn't find any information about VHS and home video profit or its production costs. So we're going to just leave that out in the ether. Before we get into anything else, what do you remember about this, if anything, at all?
Very, very little. Very, very little. I remember this movie, but man, I could not tell you. I mean, I know the plot of The Nutcracker Prince. I know the plot of the plot of the movie follows it pretty well. I know that it's animated, and I knew that Kiefer Sutherland was in it. But aside from that, I wouldn't be able to tell you anything else about it. It wasn't a regular holiday movie for me, and it
is one of those things that, like, you sort of maybe vaguely experienced and then don't remember anything else outside of that.
Yeah, like, okay. maybe it was on in a family home, like in a grandparents' home or a cousin's home or
somebody
something.
Somebody played it in the background, like,
yeah.
This will be good for the kids.
Yeah, you know, like, okay. You wake up Christmas morning and they pop in a movie while we're opening presents or something just for background noise. I don't ever recall sitting down and actually watching the damn thing.
I don't think I saw it when it came out in the theaters, although I guess maybe I might have. But I definitely, I think I suggested this.
I think you did.
I did. I think we've had several Chris's greatest hits this year. I think mostly because I was bitter that Mr. Boogity didn't get into our hat pick lottery at the beginning of the year. but Nutcracker Prince was something that we definitely watched as a family that I think it started off as something that we'd rent at the video store. I think my parents were like, oh, this seems like it'll be good for our kids. And then we're like, okay, this is fine. And then we enjoyed it. And it, I think, kind of took off as something that we watched regularly. Mm-hmm. At some point, I think we actually owned a copy, a VHS copy of this. My sister really liked it.
Did you like it?
As a kid, I remember liking it as a kid and enjoying. I think I liked the sword fighting stuff. And I like that there were cannons, and I like that that a rat gets stabbed. I thought all that stuff was kind of interesting. I actually, the sort of animated interlude, the one that you texted me about, that I never liked as a kid, but as an adult, I feel differently about it now.
Really?
I do, and we can get into it, but I some of my feelings have stayed the same, and some of them have changed, good and bad. It's kind of a weird bag today.
Well, so... So your recollection has some nostalgia attached to it. Mine really doesn't.
Yours
has
zero.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what we end up with at the end. The original story of the Nutcracker Prince, the Nutcracker, was written by E.T.A. Hoffman. And it was written back in 1816. And it was described as young Marie Stahlbaum's favorite Christmas toy, the Nutcracker, comes alive and after defeating the evil Mouse King in battle, whisks her away to a magical kingdom populated by dolls.
Yes.
And that's pretty much that's a pretty good description
of the story.
They sort of flip-flop it a little bit. Like
there's some, because I went back and I read the short story. Actually, so for those of you who don't know, Sean and I generally record these episodes way out, you know, a month or 2 months plus in advance. And we kind of had like a weird sort of snafu where I built out the notes for this episode and we kind of had 2 weeks where we couldn't record for weird various reasons.
Yeah, I was sick last week. And
then the week before, I had something happened, going on. Yeah. So I built the notes and then I was like, hey, you know what? F it. I'm just going to go ahead and I'll read it. And honestly, I added this part back in once I... had done it. The story in this movie today is almost exactly the same as the original, with a few sort of tweaks with minor... There's additional side characters added and some minor plot details. A lot of it is stuff that is just kind of streamlined for a 75-minute animated sequence.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you get the gist of it. You get the feel for what they're going for. But there are definitely differences, but not enough that... It feels like a different thing for little kids. E.T.A. Hoffman was a writer that's commonly considered a pioneer of the fantasy genre and the gothic horror genre, who has sort of flair for the macabre, and he's a early example of German romanticism, and he's kind of credited as being a primary influence of Edgar Allan Poe, Charles Dickens, and Alfred Hitchcock. So he is sort of a stalwart figure of literary classichood, if you would. The Nutcracker Ballet, however, in 1892, because the original story is written in 1816, in 1892, Tchaikovsky, if you've heard of Tchaikovsky, and a choreographer named Marius Petipa and Lev Ivanov, two choreographers, and a brilliant writer, Alexander Dumas, adapted the story into the ballet. But actually what happened was Alexander Dumas adapted the initial story into French and then helped them adapt it into a ballet.
Mm-hmm.
Is actually sort of what happened. And when the ballet first premiered, it was popular, but not that popular.
Yeah.
It was only really popular later due to the 20-minute suite that he had put together called the Nutcracker Suite. That's actually arguably his most famous work that he's ever done. And about 40% of annual American ballet tickets in the United States, their revenue is the Nutcracker.
Yeah.
So,
you see commercials for it all the time.
Yeah.
Right around the holidays.
Exactly.
And you're just flooded with that bop, 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 bop.
It's everywhere, whether it's Mannheim Steamroller or whoever. Mannheim Steamroller, I think, is the one that always plays on Coast 103.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And then Alexander Dumas, who, as a writer, I love, like, Count of Monte Cristo, Three Musketeers, and that kind of... As a writer, he's awesome.
See, I don't know. Monte Cristo is a little too rich for me.
I love Monte Cristo, man. It's too good.
Yeah, gross.
Raspberry jam and a deep-fried ham sandwich.
I was going to say, let's fry a sandwich.
Yeah, let's do it. So the screenplay is Patricia Watson, who wrote for The Road to Avonlea. I don't know if you remember
that. I don't remember it at all.
It's a weird period piece. Again, you can look at the notes. I mean, you're looking at them. I didn't put this in there, but yeah. This is because my brain is weird. But it's like this weird sort of Little House on the Prairie-ish, like a period piece, but done in Great Britain. It's weird. There's all kinds of just weird stuff associated with this. Yeah.
Now, the next person involved is kind of going to set the tone for a lot of the other people that are involved. Now, the producer of this is Kevin Gillis, who was a creator of The Raccoons. He also created Atomic Betty and Producing Parker. Now, Atomic Betty, you put a question mark next to that. That's a sort of sci-fi, it's like a retro, it was made fairly recently, I want to say in like the early 2000s, and it's sort of a retro cartoon where she's Atomic Betty is like a space-aged adventurer. Who has like a ray gun and a spaceship, and she has like a pilot who he looks like Billy from the Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy, if you've ever seen that. He's got like a big nose.
Okay.
So that's the show. The Raccoons was a fairly popular show in the late 80s. They had this Ice Capades TV special, which was not really, it was the Raccoons on Ice, but it wasn't like an Ice Capades thing. It was
Notice you're saying raccoons.
I don't know why I say raccoons.
There is controversy, man. I'm a raccoon guy. Some are raccoon. Okay.
Whatever. Sometimes let me say this. Sometimes there are instances where I have taught myself to say a word a different way than most people do. Almost as
like
a
controversy.
Yeah.
Almost which as drives a, me batty
well,
as hell.
I do
and
it,
now I do it too.
I do it as a joke, but then I've said it so many times as a joke that I just say it like that all the time. So I say raccoons and like, what's another one? Instead of saying greasy, I usually say greasy.
What?
Like I'm a greasy Italian.
Oh, okay.
So I'll say greasy and then yeah, controversy and
some of these sort of like idioms.
Yeah. And it's just stuff where I say it to say it. And now it's the way I say it. I don't even think about it.
You're going to drive your future kids mad.
Yeah. So, Kevin Gillis, he was also the composer for the RoboCop television series.
But not the one we covered.
Not the
it's
one.
It's the live action. Yeah. I don't know if you remember that.
I remember that one.
It is so, it's such a dumpster fire.
Yeah, and continuing on the trend of the raccoons, we have Paul Shibley, who was the director of this movie. He was also the director of the Raccoons TV series. And he was a storyboard artist for the animated Problem Child series, which... I didn't even know that they made. I don't think I watched that one.
I definitely don't remember that at all. The theme music is done by Victor Davies, who's best known for his self-written opera, Transit of Venus. He's done a bunch of other stuff. The production company, as I mentioned, Lacewood Productions. Lacewood Productions did the animation service for the first season of Ren and Stimpy, and they did animation production for Savage Dragon and Monster Force.
Yeah.
Allied filmmakers, this is the one. They're the ones. Super Mario Brothers 3, those assholes. Anybody involved with Super Mario Brothers 3 gets blame, in my opinion. But Allied Filmmakers also produced The Adventures of Baron Munchausen.
Super Mario 3? You mean the Super Mario Brothers Super Show from 1993?
Yes.
You said Super Mario 3.
Okay.
The video game.
Okay, well.
Nintendo did that.
God damn it.
It's okay. But they did, to be fair, they did incorporate parts of Super Mario 3 into the Super Mario Super Show. I remember that.
Yeah, they did.
That was the
Tanuki suit and some of those. So,
yeah, because it went from the super shitty original one that incorporated Mario 1 and 2, and then
Lou Albano,
and then it switched to the one with Super Mario 3 with the raccoon suit and whatever, and then it switched to Super Mario World with Yoshi. The show went through a couple different incarnations.
There's three.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, now since we're on the subject, do you remember King Koopa's Cartoon Crazies?
No.
I'll show it to you later. But look it up. If you don't remember King Koopa's Cartoon Crazies, it was a live action, think of like a Krusty the Clown type show, where there was a guy in a giant rubber King Koopa suit who showed just random like public domain cartoons to a studio full of kids who then like handed out prizes and crap.
Okay.
It was on for like a season and it was fucking just psycho fuel. Like,
you know what? We're going to put a link to it in the description if you want to go to the website and check it out. I'm found it and we'll do it. I'll watch it later.
so we can
relive the magic together.
Yeah. So let's talk about the cast. Arguably the most I would say the most famous person in this cast is the one who plays Hans and the Nutcracker.
I disagree, but I think he was probably the most popular at the time.
Yeah, definitely the most popular at the time. I actually went back. So Hans and the Nutcracker, it's the same character. They're played by Kiefer Sutherland, a 1990s Kiefer Sutherland, which would have made him, I think, 24.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, at the time, he would have been known for things like Lost Boys and Young Guns, Flatliners, Stand By Me.
Yeah.
And a couple years later, they did a live-action Three Musketeers that he was in.
Oh, yeah. And, he played Athos.
Yeah, and he was in the first Nightmare on Elm Street. And then he kind of fell off the radar. I think he had some issues. And then he came back with 24, where he was Jack Bauer.
Yeah.
And now he is the president of the United States on Designated Survivor.
Yep.
So I don't know if anybody's out there watching that, but...
Not me.
Oh, I do.
I don't have regular TV, so...
I don't either. It's on Hulu.
So, oh, okay.
Yeah. The next character is Clara, who is... done by Megan Follows, who was Anne from Anne of Green Gables, and she currently stars on the TV show Rain. And the Mouse King...
He's our primary antagonist.
Yeah. Fun side note, in the original text, the Mouse King had seven heads.
Is that the Alexander Dumas or the...
Both, yeah.
Both of them?
Yeah. The Mouse King is done by Mike McDonald, who actually is a stand-up comedian who has had a bunch of TV specials and appearances on, like, David Letterman and back on Arsenio Hall. And the next character is the one I would argue is the most famous, because the character is Pantaloon. Pantaloon is this doll that comes to life. It's one of Clara's dolls who's sort of old and kind of...
I thought it was one of the brother's dolls, because he has all the soldiers.
Oh, it might be.
Yeah.
I don't remember which dolls belong to who. I mean, I just figured it was hers, because, you know, they're all dolls.
Yeah.
But it's... Pantaloon's character is a sort of old, bumbling...
Soldier
doll whose leg is kind of sticky, and he forgets what he's doing... And he's portrayed by Peter O'Toole.
Yeah.
I think he's most famous as T.E. Lawrence from Lawrence of Arabia.
Yes.
For which he was nominated for an Oscar. And that was his first of 8 Oscar nominations, and he never won. Never won.
Did he ever get a Lifetime Achievement one?
That I don't remember. I don't remember. But Lawrence of Arabia is one of my favorite all-time films. It's a phenomenal movie. And... I think he actually holds the record for most Oscar nominations in acting without winning.
Yeah. Best actor, best actor, best actor, best actor. Best actor for all of them. Nominated. Yeah.
All best actors lose. And then just, like, look at who he loses to.
Oh, he did get an honorary Oscar.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. He probably got some.
They're probably like, well, we felt bad because we gave it to this guy, even though, you know, he's better than everybody else.
Yeah.
The next one is portrayed by Phyllis Diller, and it's the Mouse Queen. And she was one of the first female comics to become a household name. She's kind of a comedy stalwart like Lucille Ball was.
Yeah. And she has a very unique voice.
Yeah, yes, she does. Which is why, even as a kid, as a little kid, I remember going, oh, that's Phyllis Diller. Mm-hmm. And I knew exactly who that was. Because she was also pretty famous at the time that this came out. Still famous in the 1990s. She was considered a gay icon also, and she acted in over 50 movies, including A Bug's Life. I think in A Bug's Life she was the queen.
Yeah, she was the old queen.
Yeah, the elderly queen. And the next character is Uncle Drosselmeyer, who is...
He's an interesting character.
He's Hans's actual uncle, but he's nobody else's uncle.
But everyone
they
calls
all call him.
Him
uncle, which... I don't know if that means he's like the creepy neighborhood uncle or the creepy neighborhood guy who makes everybody sit on his lap and call him uncle, but he's not really. he's portrayed by Peter Boretsky, who is sort of, he's done a lot of work, but it's mostly stuff that I'm 100% unfamiliar with, and I'm pretty sure most everybody else would be too. It's a lot of older, obscure stuff. He's passed away a long time ago.
Yeah, and the thing about Drosselmeyer that I thought was interesting was that he, like, the character, the Drosselmeyer, because we're not really talking about what these characters do, so he's the one that makes all the toys. He makes the Nutcracker, he makes all of Hans's toys, but all of the brothers' toys. He makes all of Clara's toys, and he describes himself in a flashback as
an inventor.
As the king's clockmaker and court magician,
which is sort of like a nice way of saying inventor.
So he's sort of this weird old guy who knows how to make a bunch of stuff and is a little eccentric, but everyone seems to like him.
Now the next character is Trudy is a doll, and it's portrayed by Lynn Gorman, and this was her last role, as she died right before the film came out. She didn't even get to see it come out. She's born in 1920. She's been in a bunch of stuff. The next character is Dr. Stahlbaum, who I think is only in there very briefly.
Yeah.
And we've actually talked about him before, though, because he's the voice of Magneto in the 1990s X-Men animated series.
Yeah, it's George Myrna.
George Myrna. Louise is portrayed by Stephanie Morgenstern, who is Sailor Venus in the Deke English dubs for Sailor Moon, and has had a bunch of roles in video games and cartoons.
Speaking of anime voice actresses, did you know that the voice actress for Bulma in Dragon Ball died?
I had no idea.
Like, just recently. I mean, as of the recording of this episode, she was only 57.
That's way too young. That's crazy.
And she was voicing Bulma in the new Dragon Ball Super.
Oh, so they got to find a replacement.
Yeah,
now.
They're gonna have to.
Now, the next one is a character named Eric, who is done by Christopher Owens.
Is Eric the brother? No, Fritz is the brother.
Fritz is the brother. I don't know who Eric is.
Yeah.
Ms. Ingrid Stahlbaum is Diane Stapley. She hasn't done much either. The kid's mom. Princess Perlipat is done by Mona Wasserman, who was in something called My Best Friend Was an Alien, but otherwise hasn't really done anything. And yeah, I was telling you before we recorded this, I looked everywhere for My Best Friend Was an Alien, and I found something on YouTube that is not... that.
Now, we should explain that Princess Perlipet only exists in a flashback.
Yes.
There's a sequence in this, so this movie can be separated into two parts.
I'd say three.
Three parts. So there's the flashback. There's the pre-flashback where it's like present time. And then you have a flashback where Uncle Drosselmeyer is...
which takes up a good... I'd say it takes 15, 20 minutes.
It's pretty sizable. Where the animation...
Completely changes.
Changes, and it explains why... he's explaining the history of the Nutcracker that he gives to Clara. Why the Nutcracker is the way it is and what happened to his nephew. So... Princess Perlipet exists in that flashback, and then there's the latter half, which is like the fight with the rat or with the Mouse King, and then it goes into the doll land and all that stuff. Next, you have Fritz, who is the brother of Clara, who's portrayed by Noam Zilberman, and he was Rex in Tales from the Crypt Keeper episode, the one Hide and Go Shriek, the big meathead. He was Bentley Raccoon from the Raccoons, and he was in the ALF TV series with a small role.
Yeah, he was like a family, he was a family member of like a, whatever, it doesn't matter. The next one is the King, it's Len Carlson, and we've talked about Len Carlson a lot, and Len Carlson actually does 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 other roles.
He's essentially additional voices.
Yes, as well as the King. And he is Bert Raccoon from the Raccoons. He's Big Boss from Cops, which is something that we've had a request for. He was Herc Storm Sailor from Jace and the Wheeled Warriors. And, of course, Sean's favorite Ganon from The Legend of Zelda. And the next is Mr. Schaefer, who, as a character, there's like... a whole other list of other characters. That's done by Marvin Goldhar. And he has had roles on The Busy World of Richard Scarry, Garbage Pail Kids, Starcom, Dino Saucers. He was Mayor Davis in Cops. Cedric Sneer from The Raccoons. Are you noticing a pattern with the raccoons?
Yeah, a lot of raccoons.
And the next is a guy named Keith Hampshire, the voice actor Keith Hampshire, who has 1, 2, 3, 4. He has a bunch of other additional voices.
Basically, everyone else on this list are people that did additional voices, but they actually got credit for the characters they did. So you have Keith Hampshire, who's a singer-songwriter. His song OK Blue Jays was adopted as a theme song for the Toronto Blue Jays. They sing it during the seventh inning stretch.
And the next is Marie, and that's actually portrayed by our long-mentioned voice actor, Elizabeth Hanna, and we've mentioned her a bunch of times. So, first was Legend of Zelda as the Triforce of Wisdom, but she's also the Old Witch from Tales from the Crypt Keeper, Delia Dietz in the animated Beetlejuice series, Rosie O'Gravy, that we just talked about back on Dog City, and the Wicked Witch in the Toho animated Wizard of Oz. I've been pushing for that. We'll see. The last two voice actors are Susan Roman, who is Lita / Sailor Moon from Jupiter, from the Deke dubbed version of Sailor Moon, and a bunch of characters from The Raccoons, and Champ Bear from the Care Bears TV series, and the heroine from Rock and Rule named Angel. And this is weird because we have had a bunch of times where we've mentioned Rock and Roll, and I know that that's also on our request list, so maybe we'll get to that
we'll
as well.
Do it. We'll do
it. We'll do it. And the last person is Teresa Sears, who's a voice actress who's done a bunch of roles, including the raccoons and the Care Bears. So, do you want to get into... We could kind of go two directions today. We can either get into the plot of it, or we can get into the thing that I was talking about.
Let's talk about the plot, because then we can talk about that other stuff, too. So, the plot of this movie is very similar to the plot of the original story, in that you have a family, a fairly well-to-do family in what appears to be Russia?
Germany.
Okay, so a fairly well-to-do family in like 1800s Germany who...
Yeah. See, the original writer was German.
Okay, so it makes sense.
And so I figured... And then they eat streusel there's Christmas tree stuff, so...
Yeah, in Germany, the Christmas tree is a German thing.
Yeah.
The old Tannenbaum.
Yeah.
But, so you have the story of Clara and Fritz, who are brother and sister, who are going around doing stuff before Christmas, and then they run home to see the lighting of their tree, which I love old Christmas trees, or seeing old Christmas trees, because you have the...
I'm terrified.
Yeah.
Whenever I see it, I'm terrified.
You have a giant piece of timber sitting in someone's house.
Combustible timber.
And of course, they light candles on the tree, all over the tree, to light it up.
I wonder how many house fires were resulted from that. I mean, I know that traditionally they would actually have those like little metal guards on the back to kind of keep
them help push the glow of the candle out,
the glow
and
the heat
also
away from the tree.
Yeah, exactly. But it's funny. So they dress the tree and they light it and they're all excited. And then Uncle Drosselmeyer comes over. So then the kids start opening their presents, and Fritz gets some toy soldiers and Clara gets the Marie doll, and they're in love. And they also have an older sister who gets like a dress.
The thing about Uncle Drosselmeyer when he comes in is he's very eccentric, and he comes in with explosive fireworks.
Yeah.
And in a giant toy mechanical castle that the kids are actually not that interested with.
And he actually chastises them for it. He's like,
yes.
Because Fritz asks.
Again, this is all from the original writings. All of this is from the original writings with the mechanical castle and them not being interested in him sort of being like kids today.
Yeah.
People have been saying kids these days for hundreds of years.
They've been saying
it
since there's been kids.
Going back really quick, did you notice when the kids first meet Uncle Drosselmeyer in his shop or outside of his shop or whatever, they talk to him about whatever, and then as they walk away, he does some sort of magic and he goes, "Tonight." And all I could think of was, "Tonight. You." From Aqua Teen Hunger Force with Banana Hand. I don't know why, but I thought of that. And then the other thing that I was thinking about is, where do these kids live that nobody cares about them walking along and falling off of the roofs of buildings?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, it was a simpler time.
It was a simpler time where we could just make more kids.
Yeah, it's fine. Just free labor through sex.
Yeah. So they have a Christmas party at their parents' house where Uncle Drosselmeyer does a whole show with his mechanical castle that he brings in. And then he gives the kids, or he shows the kid, a new toy or a new doll that he has. He doesn't claim that he makes it. And it's a Nutcracker. So he's like, you know, he shows him how it works. And then
Fritz is a little asshole and cracks a marble in it and breaks it.
It's one of his cannonballs. Yeah. So he breaks it and Clara freaks out on him, and then they end up going to bed, and Clara hears some...
Well, no, Uncle Drosselmeyer tells a story.
Oh, that's right. This is where the flashback...
Now we get the flashback. So, now, this is the thing that you texted me about, because at this point, he tells a story about he had a young apprentice, which was his nephew, Hans.
Yeah.
And tells this whole story about what happens, and the animation style completely changes.
And I really didn't like it.
Do you want to talk about the animation both before and then during? Because the animation is fairly well done.
I think,
pre-flashback. Although the people moving around on the ground and the snow, particularly when they're running, feels really floaty.
Yeah. The running is not great. It's
anything
sort of
outside
like
a Disney always feels floaty.
Yeah, the running sort of feels like a Don Bluth movie where it's just like when they move too quickly, they don't.
It's almost
look right.
Like moonwalking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the overall, I liked the animation in
the pre and post
flashback. It was good animation. It was sort of that I mean, I don't know how to describe it. It seemed kind of Don Bluthy a little bit, not really Disney so much. It seemed a little
bit... But it was well done.
Yeah, it was well
Especially
done.
Especially the rats were well animated, and the dolls. Yeah.
But the animation during the flashback, it just, I mean, as much as a movie that's designed for kids, made in 1990, can hold my interest, the animation in the flashback just complete, it was like I was watching a completely different movie. It was not just the animation, it was also the way that the characters acted. Because you get a complete shift in animation, and then you get these characters that act ridiculous, like the king and the queen act ridiculous. And in the beginning part, pre and post flashback, you have as much as they can be like realistic characters that are based in like a reality that we would be familiar with. Yeah. And the characters in the flashback were more like in a Looney Tunes reality.
Yeah, so it actually didn't remind me of Looney Tunes. Well, sort of. It reminded me of a mix between Looney Tunes and Hanna-Barbera.
Yeah, no, that's what I... Yeah.
That the backgrounds all of a sudden lost a lot of their definition in luster, mm-hmm. but then also a lot of the lines went from being very straight and very, like, well-drawn to almost intentionally cartoony.
Yeah, like Yogi Bear.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, Yogi Bear is a great way to sort of describe it. So this is how I felt about it at the time when I was a kid. I didn't like this part at all as a kid. As a child, I hated this part. I thought it was boring. I didn't understand the point. I was like, I just want to see the sword fighting. I just want to get back to regular times. As an adult, I was trying to figure out, why did they do this way? Like, what happened?
I don't know. I don't know why you would change the style of the movie.
Well, I think what they were trying to do is, it's a flashback. And not only is it a flashback, but it's more of a storytelling flashback. So it's more like... I actually didn't see it so much as a flashback, so much as I saw it as her mental imagining of the story that he was recounting.
Okay.
Because he tells the story, and he is sort of narrating the flashback. And so she is kind of, in her mind's eye, imagining, which I felt was like why it all felt warped and exaggerated.
Yeah.
Because it's the world imagined through the eyes of like a prepubescent...
Like a 13-year-old.
12, 13-year-old.
I guess so, I could see that, but you don't get... I mean, as a kid, you wouldn't get that. You're just like,
no.
Here's a dramatic tonal shift in a movie.
It's a complete tonal shift. I think it's a poor choice either way. It makes a lot more sense when you try to think about it through that lens. But at the same time, I just don't... I don't think it was a good idea. I think some of it was clever. Some of the way that they tried to tell the story... Some of the ways that they would animate the characters to be like intentionally kind of grotesque or weird looking, but it just doesn't fit. It's a part of the movie that just doesn't mesh with everything else.
Yeah, this part introduces you to the Mouse Queen and her son, and the Mouse Queen is some kind of sorceress, and she curses your Princess Parapet.
Eyes like azure, be as stone. Teeth like pearls, be as bone. Ugly as the night is long. Never man shall right this wrong.
And that is the curse that she puts on the princess to make her ugly, essentially because she does not like this royal family. And... my daughter didn't like this part. She said it was too spooky and scary. She hid herself behind her hands during that little spellcasting thing. She didn't like that part. But she more or less was on board for the rest of the movie. But that one part was a little weird for her. And I don't know. I don't know if it was the animation of the princess itself or if it was the way that they... had her voice acted, but I didn't care for her sections at all.
No. And the king was an asshole.
But I didn't mind the king, the way he was like animated and vocalized, but the princess is aggravating.
Yeah.
Super aggravating.
So they go through this whole story of how Hans tried to, like, no one in the kingdom could cure the princess of her ugly ailment, and that it was a very specific thing that someone had to do. They had to crack this uncrackable nut with their mouth.
Called the crack-a-tooth nut.
Yeah, and everybody was breaking their tooth. So
the original writing, it's the crack-a-took. but close enough. Yeah.
So nobody can crack this nut. And turns out Hans can crack it with his mouth. And then he has to, I think, blindfold himself, feed it to her, and then take 7 steps backwards. And he's able to crack the nut, he feeds it to her. And then as he's taking 7 steps backward, the mouse queen comes up and chomps him on the leg and curses him to essentially turn into a nutcracker.
And in the original writings, what happens is he takes 6 steps back and... he loses his balance, and when he does, the princess is saved, but he is turned into a nutcracker.
So that explains.
But he's still, but not just a nutcracker like doll. In the initial story, he's a nutcracker, but he's still a man, but he's a man that looks like a nutcracker.
Oh.
So he's like this grotesque. I mean, think about how terrifying that would be.
That would be terrifying.
And so they don't want anything to do with him because he's grotesque and ugly. And in the initial text, the way that he is cured is by being told that he is loved regardless of him being a nutcracker. And so that is what changes him into a prince and into a man, and then him. And so that's kind of the real story. But in this one, he is turned into it by the bite of the queen mouse.
Okay.
Which then causes him to fall back in a column fall over, which kills the queen mouse.
And enrages the now mouse king because his mother is dead. His mother dying doesn't enrage him. It's that his tail was bent.
Yes.
Because his tail got crushed.
He's actually happy she's dead, because then he gets a crown.
Yeah, so his tail gets crushed, and that's what drives him crazy. And that becomes a running gag later on, that a bunch of stuff keeps happening to his tail. It either gets burnt or crushed again. And
yeah.
My tail!
At this point, it goes back to the point, the animation style that we're okay with.
Mm-hmm.
We go back to present time, and... So the story fades and she goes to bed, and now we get the sort of third act, and Clara wakes up in the middle of the night and she goes to go look in at her nutcracker, and we get this little exposition, and I like expositions for kids movies because, and really I think just for myself, for these kind of movies, because otherwise we'd have no idea.
Yeah.
They tell us who these characters are, the dolls, mm-hmm. So we find out who the dolls are and what they do. And they're a little bit about their personality, so that we're giving context, because it's only 75 minutes.
Yeah.
So it's not like we have time to form a relationship with these characters. So there's no character development time.
Yeah.
So we're given like a quick, like, this is what they are, this is how you should feel, and then go.
Yeah, and then we get into a battle between the mouse. I keep wanting to call him the.
We also get a very 90s song sung by Clara.
Oh, which yeah. Then we get a battle, and I want to keep calling him the Rat King because he is significantly larger than all the other mice in his
employ.
Joy
kept calling him the Rat King, and I was like, "You do ballet, you know he's called the Mouse King. Why are you calling him the Rat King?"
Well, he's at least twice the size of all the other mice that he commands, and they have a battle between the Mouse King and his people, and then all of the toy soldiers that Pantaloon commands.
Did you notice the mice all shouting like fight, 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 fight? All I could think of was Jerry.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And
why.
The mice are all using like they're catapulting like marbles and all kinds of just debris and flotsam and jetsam they find on the ground. And the Mouse King is the only one that actually has a sword. The only people that have actual weapons are the Mouse King and Pantaloon. They both have swords.
Yeah.
And the other ones have like the soldiers have cork guns, and they shoot marbles out of their cannons. And so you go through this whole long fight sequence, and then
well animated, considering.
And then the Nutcracker takes Pantaloon's sword.
Because Pantaloon gets injured.
Pantaloon gets injured. He takes Pantaloon's sword, and he goes and fights the Mouse King, and ends up stabbing him, and he falls out of the tree, the Mouse King does. And then they essentially are like, well, let's go back to Doll Land.
Yeah. Well, the thing about this, I mentioned it before we recorded, is that Pantaloon is just rife with Shakespearean quotes.
Yeah.
So at one point we get a quote from Richard III with the line, "If not to heaven, then hand in hand to hell." Which is a very, very famous Shakespearean quote from Richard III. And we get a bunch of other ones, and we can kind of get into that later. I actually really like that. I thought that was cool. But I also felt like, why? What's the purpose? None of these children watching this are going to get this. This has to be in there for the parents to feel like they're giving their kids some sort of culture.
Well, The thing that they say about Pantaloon, it's the old lady doll mm-hmm. describes, or no, it's when Pantaloon is introducing himself to the Nutcracker. He says that he studied lots of literature and he studied all kinds of war tactics and he knows a lot of stuff about a lot of
hence
stuff.
Hence Richard III.
So yeah.
Which is sort of a
but then it's also,
homage there.
So it's also sort of an homage to Peter O'Toole and his Shakespearean background, I'm guessing.
I figured that was part of what it was. One of the things that Eleanor really liked about this was one of the mice gets set on fire, which made Eleanor belly laugh really hard. And then Joy asked her why she was laughing. And she said, it's okay. I can laugh at him since he's the bad guy. That's why I'm laughing.
That's awesome.
I was like, that is true. But that's weird, for you to be so, self-aware, but okay. So then Clara essentially gets knocked out when she trips after trying to save the Nutcracker by throwing her shoe at the Mouse King. And she ends up spending the next day in bed. And she,
they find her in the sitting room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the Mouse King comes to her bedside and threatens to kill the Nutcracker. So she traps him in a drawer, injuring his tail. And she runs downstairs to get her toys and
to essentially try and wake up the Nutcracker.
Yeah, and the Mouse King threatens her cat Pavlova, who is the cat is actually named after
a famous Russian ballet dancer.
Yeah, ballet Anna dancer. Pavlova, and she was a world famous ballet dancer around the turn of the century. But you thought
I thought it was something different. So When I was watching it, her name is Pavlova, and I thought she was named after Pavlov, the behavioralist, because she had a bell on the whole time, and the bell was always sounding. And so I thought, it makes more sense that they named her after a ballet dancer rather than a psychological behavioralist.
But see, well, I guess that's where our brains go. So, yeah. You know, we end up with this next fight where the Nutcracker sword fights the Mouse King, and that is where we get the injury by Pantaloon.
Yeah, Pantaloon tries to interfere when the Mouse King is about to like deliver a killing blow to the Nutcracker, and Pantaloon grabs the Mouse King's feet or something and pulls him.
Yeah.
And then he gets batted away
and injured.
And he gets injured, and some of his clockwork gets messed up.
Now, at some point during this fight, the Nutcracker stabs the Mouse King and he falls from the Christmas tree, and we think that that's the end. We don't see that physically happen. It's a cut. I mean, he gets stabbed and then he starts to fall in a cutaway.
Yeah. And then you see the Nutcracker's sword has blood on it.
Yeah. So
which
you
is
just kind of.
Something you don't normally see in a kid's movie.
Yeah. We're going to get to that part too.
yeah.
Eleanor, by the way, was really into that whole part of the movie. She really liked the sword fight part. She thought it was really cool. She got up and pretended to sword fight.
Nice.
She was like really into it. Now, at this point, Pantaloon's quotes become jumbled. And they decide that they're going to take him to go save him by taking him to the land of the dolls.
Yeah.
And so now at this point, we get a misquote from King John. The actual quote is, "Heaven take thy soul and England keep my bones." But he misquotes it as,
"Heaven take my bones, England keep my soul."
And so they end up in the land of the dolls. As soon as they end up in the land of the dolls, though, all of his quotes go back to normal.
Yeah, he like heals himself.
And he quotes Richard III again with, "Now is the summer of our discontent." And there's like coconut frosting instead of snow and giant flying swans. And it's all gingerbread castles and shit.
Yeah, and the whole point of this is really like, I don't understand what the whole point of this like last part, this last act is. Because they essentially go to the land of the dolls. And nothing happens until the Mouse King shows up.
Well, no. What happens is they want her to stay forever.
Oh, and she says she can't.
In the original story, the Mouse King's been defeated already. And the Nutcracker has invited her to stay with him in the Land of Dolls forever. And she says that she loves him, and that's what transforms him. And
He turns back into Bob,
there's your uncle.
A real boy.
But in this one, she says that she can't stay there forever because she wants to someday grow up and that they're all not real. And as soon as she starts to say that, all the toys start turning back into toys and losing their ability to
ambulate.
And the Mouse King shows up with the flesh wound.
Pretty serious flesh wound.
A pretty serious flesh wound, you know. And she throws food at him until he falls off the balcony.
Yeah, he goes for like a big cleave with his sword, and she ducks out of the way, and he goes tumbling over.
Well,
the...
at this point, everybody disappears, and Clara wakes up in bed. So I was thinking,
was it a dream?
Hallucination from a head injury.
Or perhaps it was the mercury they probably fed her.
Well, you know, it could have been
both. Or the arsenic or something. Maybe they gave her a little touch of cocaine for the pain.
Sure, why not? Let's do it.
Yeah. Hey, why not?
Yeah.
So the ending, the climax of this movie, actually, you brought up before, and we can talk about it now. One of the criticisms lobbed by a fairly renowned critic, Roger
We've mentioned
Ebert.
Him before. He's like my favorite sort of historical movie critic.
So one of the criticisms that he had was that essentially this movie was too violent.
Yeah, he said that the film is mediocre and innocuous, more or less, but gets majorly hung up on the fact that the villain is physically killed within the climax of the film, and then he gave it 2 stars.
Mm-hmm.
My opinion is that his opinion about the film is worth its own conversation, because his review starts off with, where did it start? This idea in our society that death was a solution. Wasn't there a time when children's stories were more innocent and ended with victory and defeat, vindication and success, rather than with a fight to the finish? And then he goes on to describe how awful it is that there's killing in a children's animated film, and, you know, woe is the children, and all the hand-wringing. Yeah, and at one point he even mentions the storytelling in which he sort of poo-poos the storytelling and says that nothing in the animation of the story shows anything but the most conventional minds at work. And I thought, most conventional? You mean a stalwart figure of the Romanticism era and Alexandre Dumas? Do you mean by that? Because it's basically the same story.
I want to know what maybe there's something about what he reviewed leading up to this movie. Like maybe he watched a couple of kids' movies. Because I get what he's saying a little bit. But the thing is, was this originally written, the original short story, was it originally written to be a children's story?
No, it was just written as a story. But see, this, there was no, like, quote, children's story. There was a story. Like, think about back to the early age of film. Okay, what? So if you go back to the very early days of film.
There was just film.
There was just film. And so if you were a 5-year-old, 8-year-old kid sneaking into the you know, local penny theater or dime theater, you're going to go in and see a movie, and it's just a movie. There's no, quote, children's movie. You know, Disney movies, for instance, those were movies for everybody. Those weren't just, quote, kids' movies because they were cartoons. In fact, Bugs Bunny was very much considered to be, you know, adult thematically oriented, you know? And so this idea that there's, quote, children's consumed media and then adult consumed media is a weird thing, because at the time that the story was written, there wasn't. Now, granted, in the initial ballet and story, was there a stab to the heart, or is it just less alluded to?
Here's the thing, though, is that in 1816, when the story was originally written, I would wonder at the literacy rate for children in 1816, especially in Germany, and whether or not they would actually be expected to be able to read a story like this.
Well,
or whether,
it's probably more class-based.
Like upper-class children, you know,
that was,
maybe.
You know, that was like what with the that was still part of the German Empire when there was still
the Ottomans? No.
No, this is still part of the German Empire pre-World War I, when there was a, you know, a Kaiser.
Yeah.
Right? But what I mean, the thing is the stories that are written for whoever's going to read them. And so the people who'd be reading would be middle and upper class people who could read. And although that population was small by comparison at the time compared to now, it then gets reworked as a play or as a ballet in the late 1800s. So it's...
Here's the problem, I think, with Roger Ebert isn't some infallible sage of all of movie.
No, I think sometimes he had been sort of alluded to that back when he was alive.
Yeah. So here's the thing about...
That's why I always like to go to him, because he normally knows what he's talking about, but a lot of times he'll say things that are in the same vein that everybody else seems to be saying.
His lament in his review is essentially that at least in this one, and I guess in more children's literature that he's familiar with or children's movies, he's upset, it seems, that they are not more complicated story-wise. Because what he talks about is, you know, why do we tell children that the only way to solve a problem is to kill the person who's creating the problem? Which I guess is a legitimate gripe. He says, why can't they learn to talk about it and try and change their minds or do this and that? And like everything outside of
media that shows that.
Yeah, everything outside of violence. And I think what that negates is the
Care Bears movie came out before this, and they didn't. There ain't no stabbing of any Mouse King.
They just
love somebody too much. They judgmentally made them nice.
They judgmentally stare at them until they start acting like they should.
Well, hey, you know, that's another solution.
Yeah, they're actually they're like publicly shaming them.
No,
Hitler just wanted to hug all the Jews.
I'm sure that's exactly what he wanted.
But no, so the problem is that you sometimes you need a simple story
to like convey this, the message.
To convey the message. And sometimes you create a character that is so evil as a villain, as an antagonist, that what is the solution? You're either going to imprison them forever because they're crazy and psychopathic, or you're going to kill them.
Right, because you've created an archetype that is non-redeemable.
Yeah, and lot of times what they do in those situations, and you talked about before when we were going over the review, you had brought up the evil witch in Snow White and whether Ebert would have lamented that they killed her. But now that I'm thinking about it, I feel like a lot of times when they have that stuff in kids' movies, they make it so that the hero doesn't necessarily kill them. It's that the villain gets killed because of their own actions. Like,
so it's hubris that kills the villain.
Yeah, because if you think about it, in this movie, the Mouse King is trying to kill Clara, and he goes to swing his sword at her, and he essentially like loses his footing and falls over the railing.
Right, so here we are. He dies by his own hubris.
Yeah, and the same thing happened to the Evil Queen in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. She's up on top of a mountain. She's trying to shimmy a big boulder onto the dwarves, and then lightning bolt strikes the mountain and she falls down, and then the rock falls on top of her. So it's not something that the hero did to do. Now that I'm thinking back on all of it, like the only movie that I can think of where the hero actually killed the villain, I'm thinking of Disney movies, is in Sleeping Beauty.
Little Mermaid. Prince Eric intentionally steered the front end of a ship into Ursula's.
Stabs the shit out of her.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's few and far between. Most of the time in movies, when a villain gets killed, it's because of something he did or she did. Like something the character did.
Yeah.
And I think that's the part that Ebert was forgetting about. Is that it shows... I think it shows more...
That the evil doesn't pay,
More than it shows that the only solution to this problem is the hero literally killing the villain, which is not what happened. The only solution, most of the time what the solution is, or what the message is that if you go down this path, bad things are probably going to happen to you.
Right, that's the way that I've always, I mean, growing up indoctrinated by these kinds of movies... That is the way that I've always taken it, because I always kind of felt like, well, they defended themselves, and defending themselves is never what killed the villain.
Yeah, and usually...
Except for Prince Eric, but technically Prince Eric isn't the hero of the film, it's Princess Ariel.
Yeah.
She is the protagonist, right?
Yeah, but
he's a sort of side character.
Prince Philip wasn't the protagonist of Sleeping Beauty, and he
that's also true.
He lit that sword lit on fire and thrust it into Maleficent's chest.
I mean, so there's two of those.
Yeah, but that's the thing I think that is a good, it's sort of an unintentional takeaway from this movie, and it's just a message that the Mouse King, by and large, was like an evil guy.
He's a true evil archetype. He was not meant to be a redeemable character, and I think the part about the reason why I wanted to talk about this review so much is. I take issue with the argument that it's the kids these days argument that I sort of jokingly referred to earlier in this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
It's the idea that, you know, why is it the kids these days, this is the message that we send them and like blah, blah, blah. But like, he probably grew up watching Gunsmoke. I mean,
yeah,
you know what I mean? Come on. Or Lone Ranger, where they're killing bad guys every week.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that's nothing. John Wayne movies. He was probably watching John Wayne movies as a kid. Those were not meant for children, but they were just part of regular media consumption.
Yeah.
The moral of the story there is, bad guy gets shot by John Wayne. Like, that's, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So, I guess, ultimately, what did you think about this movie?
So, outside of Ebert's stupid review...
That's not usually a sentence you can say.
No, it's not. Normally, he's a pretty smart guy, but his review was dumb. But the discussion about this exposure to violence and killing being the only solution for children and blah, blah, I think that's a crock. It's a load of crock. Mm-hmm. And I really don't like that argument because I feel like it cheapens what we expect out of our children.
Mm-hmm.
We should expect more. We should expect them to put the pieces together.
Yeah.
And if you don't think that they can, then explain it to them. That's your job.
Yeah.
That is our job as parents and then at large as society. Now, with that said, my thoughts on the movie. I don't, you know, is it something that I'll be excited to watch again? No. Am I okay with watching it if my kid wants to watch it? Sure. In fact, she's wanted to watch it since then. So... would I recommend it? God, this is always the hard one for me. If you've never seen it before, go ahead. Sure. What the hell? I mean, you know me. I say watch anything.
Mm-hmm.
Just fucking watch anything. But if you haven't seen it before, go ahead and watch it. But if you're looking for something in particular, you're probably not going to find it. You'll probably be better off just listening to the review.
Yeah.
But for kids, totally a good Christmas movie to have in rotation for kids. It's safe. It's entertaining. My kid really enjoyed it. It's nothing, you know, offensive. I think it's probably going to be good for kids. I'd say the age range is probably in the, I'd say 4 year to 4 to 11 year old range, right somewhere in there.
Yeah.
So what about you? What do you think this week?
So here's the thing. This movie, to me, there's nothing inherently bad about it.
Right.
There's also nothing inherently good about it. This movie, to me, is mediocre through and through. It's not particularly memorable. It's not particularly compelling. It's fluff. I mean, I really think that the flashback aspect of it really takes a lot away because it takes a good chunk. In a 75-minute movie, if you've got 20 minutes of essentially backstory filler that is tonally and stylistically different than the rest of the movie, you've sacrificed, what is that, like nearly a third of your runtime?
They could have done the flashback in a 5-minute sequence using toys.
Yeah.
That would have been really interesting.
Yeah.
But they didn't.
But ultimately... this movie is, you know, I'll agree in one aspect of Ebert's review is that this movie is ultimately innocuous.
Yeah, I agree with
nothing,
that.
There's nothing harmful about this movie. So if you want to turn it on for kids during Christmas, then go ahead. I think that overall people would be better served by going and watching the ballet because that's you get a little bit more culture.
Absolutely.
A little bit about.
We're taking Eleanor to the ballet, taking her to go see the ballet for this. Probably around the time that this debuts, the time that this episode comes out. So.
Yeah, so ultimately, like, I can't recommend it, but I can't also say, like, don't watch it. It's okay. Just like, if it's on TV, if it's on Fox Family or ABC Family or whatever, and it's on in the background, go ahead and watch it. But I wouldn't seek this movie out. It's nothing special. It could have been. I mean, I've seen the ballet. The ballet's good.
Yeah.
Normally when I see it, I mean, I've seen it from different people.
Yeah, the music is great. The story itself, the way that it's written, is a good story.
Yeah. Maybe go, first of all, go read the short story. Secondly, go see the ballet. And then third, if you still want to, go watch this movie.
Yeah. If you want to use this, maybe, here's a good way to put it. If you want to take your kid to go see the ballet, have them watch this first as a sort of soft introduction. Mm-hmm. To the ballet so that they can recognize characters and point stuff out so that they're more engaged. It's a sort of trick that you do with children when you want them to, say, get into a musical.
Mm-hmm.
Is you first, you just play the soundtrack around the house. And so that they know the music as you're cleaning and doing whatever, they just get used to hearing the music. So then when the music comes on, they know the song. And so then when you go to watch the movie, then they go, oh, I know that song.
And they're more into it.
And now they're more into it. So like, if you want your kid to enjoy something, kind of indoctrinate them. This is a good way to indoctrinate your children into watching a ballet.
Yay. Put it that way. Indoctrination.
Indoctrination. So
that'll probably do it for this week.
Yeah, we got one more, I think. No, two more.
Two more
for to finish out
for
the
this
rest
holiday
of the,
season.
For this holiday season, should we mention what we're going to do this the rest of this month? Keep going with the surprises we've been
surprises.
Doing.
Surprises.
Sure. What the hell? We have one live action coming at the end of the month.
Yeah.
And we have a not live action, but not animated.
Yeah, I'd say that.
Yeah, okay, I'll say that. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
So that'll do it. That'll do it for this episode. So
if you want to find us and talk to us on Twitter, our Twitter handle is @remasteredcast. That is @remasteredcast.
You can also find us on Facebook. Just search for Childhood Remastered. Please rate us 5 stars on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. The rating really helps us out.
Yeah, and we'd also like to thank John Howarth for the use of our intro music, Nascent. You can find links to his SoundCloud on our website, childhoodremastered.com.
And until next time, this is Sean.
And Chris.
And this has been your Childhood Remastered. We will see you next time.